I'm Kim. I'm a real alcoholic. I say that because when I came in, I didn't think I was a real alcoholic. I had planned to drink. I didn't think real alcoholics planned to drink. This is the deal. I actually got sober down here almost 23 years ago. I was in a halfway house, not parlor. I didn't plan on coming to a halfway house. I actually came down for a three-hour tour. I thought that I was, this is August 27th on 2002. I thought I was coming down to rehab to get off some pain pills that I was convinced were interfering with my drinking, because I was on those pain pills, and I was convinced that since I'd been on those pain pills, they were screwing up my drinking. I came down and got off of those. I could drink like a normal person, and like I thought I was going to be able to drink. They kept me. First, they kept me for like 7 days in the detox unit, and I was all messed up for that. And then they sent me to the lodge for another 3 weeks. And then they sent me for 60 days to a halfway house, hence why I was coming here. So that's kind of how I got here, but I'm going to tell you the backstory. So they tell me this is how we qualify. We qualify by telling you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'm going to tell you, I had my first drink when I was 11. I drank for 33 years. I've been sober for 23. I told you everything that happened during that time, we would probably be here for a few hours. So I'm going to try to condense it, give you the abridged version. I actually was born up in New York State to a group of Yankees. You know, when you come in here, they tell you you're going to have to change your playmates and playgrounds. And for me, that would have been my entire family. You know, we drank everything. Everything was involving alcohol. It was so embedded in our lives that I couldn't conceive of a life that somehow didn't have alcohol in every aspect of our lives. I mean, we were camping, there was alcohol. It was Saturday night, we had alcohol. Everything was alcohol, camping, bowling, everything. It was normal to me. It didn't seem to be. People came over, we had parties, and people were puking, passing out. I mean, you know, sometimes you had to call the ambulance, take them to the hospital. That, to me, was normal living. Didn't see anything wrong about that. That's how everybody lived. So I wouldn't have considered myself to be, you know, people would throw up and alcohol and say, well, that was just a waste of liquor, you know. I mean, that's just how we lived. So growing up, we were having the parties. When I was about 11, I was always the one hiding in the corner. I was the introvert. I wasn't out there talking to everybody because I always felt like I was too odd and I didn't fit in. But my friends and I, we broke into that liquor camp that was there, you know, and we started drinking. Well, all of a sudden, I didn't feel so abnormal. I all of a sudden could talk and be laughing, and it's like I was walking through this through life, and all of a sudden I seemed like I was upright. I belonged, and I didn't have to conform somehow to belong. I could be odd and funny and bizarre, and people laughed if I laughing at me, but I just seemed like I fit. And so after that, you know, it was ridiculous. I ended up getting thrown up all over my friends, and they were grossed out, but I thought it was funny, and I just wanted to do it again. So, you know, the rest of my high school years, what I remember is just wanting to pursue alcohol every opportunity I got. And so that's what I did. We lived up in New York State, and that's all I remember. My parents moved from New York State to Florida when I was in high school. That was kind of interrupted my plans, but that's what we did. And, you know, I'm not going to go through all my high school years, so that's just crazy. I'm going to tell you, I got married at age 16, 17, because I was pregnant, you know, because you don't have any control when you just lose kind of when you do stuff like that, you know, no impulse control. My husband and I, we drank at each other because he was an alcoholic too, right? We just drank at each other. We ended up having two kids. We lost one, and right after we lost that other one, we moved to Columbus, Georgia, so that geographical cure, you know. And, you know, and I just think about what our lives were like down there. Of course, I got a job at a bar because that was convenient. You got to be able to have a drink for your work. He would come to the bar and drink, and I would work, and I, you know, just our lives just went on being just that insanity, you know, just up there. And so I think about, you know, he ended up divorcing me. So he said he would love me better if he wasn't married to me. And I would tell you that he just didn't want all the drama of, you know, the losing the kids and everything. It was just recently that I recalled something, and I thought, I was telling somebody at a party just recently that, you know, it never occurred to me that maybe he didn't want to be married to me. there was a thing that we talk about how, like I was saying, that I always planned to drink. It never occurred to me that I didn't plan to drink. And you know how we talk about how we can't tell the truth from the false when we first come in? This is how deep it goes for me. I recalled an incident where I was working at a bar, And I called him up and said, it was like 1 o'clock in the morning, closing the bar down. I said, hey, put on some toast and some tea and I'll be home. And I meant it. I called him, I'm going to be home. And I don't know what happened. Probably alcohol went by and I was like, ah, there it is. And but I didn't go home. I ended up going to my boss's house for the party. And at 3, there were some cops there because they had come by because they were part of the, you know, bouncers at the room. And about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, the next thing I know, I'm coming out of a blackout, and the cops were there, and he told my boss, hey, there's an APB out on her. You know, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. You know, I pick up the phone to tell my husband, hey, I'm on my way home. And I scared the bejesus out of him because I called him and say, I'm on my way home, and then he doesn't hear from me anymore. And it never occurred to me to think, oh, that's probably why he probably didn't want to be married to me anymore because of all the stuff that I did to him. So here I am telling myself this lie. That I can't be an alcoholic because I always plan to drink. I don't know that I planned that night. Apparently I didn't. I planned to go home, but then I didn't. And it didn't occur to me just until about 2 months ago that that was the truth. Because we just don't see it, right? Because that alcohol, I thought it was my best friend. I thought that I was planning to drink and I was always doing something. Like it was a consensual relationship, me and alcohol. But I don't know how much you can consent to something when it impairs your judgment. And that was just what it was always like. So he divorces me, and I go on about my merry way. I meet the next victim, I mean husband. And he's better. We don't drink at each other because he's more into drugs. So it's a good combination, right? He does his drugs, and I do my alcohol, and he takes better care of me. So that seemed to be working out. And I'm still a little crazy. I do crazy things. Like just I one weekend I was working at a bar, and my friend asked me to come work at with her. It was a strip club. But that bar, they actually, if you got the people to buy you a drink, they gave you a dollar and you got to drink the drink. I'm really loving this job. My dad, and if they bought you a bottle of champagne, you got to sit down and drink it with them, and you got $10 left. Now, this is like, you know, in the 80s. This is a lot of money. And I'm really thinking this is the best job ever. My parents found out about it. My father came to the strip club to check on me to find out what the hell is his daughter doing. And he walks in, and the first thing I say is, Daddy, Daddy, buy me a drink. I get to drink it and get paid a dollar. And I'm sure they were thinking, is she out of her mind? And to me, again, I'm just thinking, this is fun and normal. That's just a little bit about how crazy and out of control I was. But at some point, my drug addict husband, who was so out of control, I decided I can't go on living quite this crazy, so I decided to go to nursing school. And let me tell you about nursing school. Now, that's where you really learn to be in control. So this is where I got better at functioning, because he was so out of control, I couldn't go on living that way. So I figured out how to be more functional. So I learned how to mix a little of this, mix a little of that, you can actually keep the psychosis away, and you can work better. So things got a bit smoother for me, and I actually worked better, and I wasn't quite that crazy person like with the bars. I could actually work in the hospital. And the cool thing about it was, I didn't do drugs to get high like he did. I actually used them strategically so I could keep the, you know, keep it smoother. So I was before clinical at night. This is crazy. 6 o'clock at night. I thought, okay, no more alcohol, no more drugs. I'll be clean for clinical. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, the next morning, I'd be like this. You know, thinking I was nervous about clinical, I was probably just detoxing off of drugs. So that was, you know, I can remember during some of these times, like going to my family, a couple of parties, get-togethers, and my mom saying, Kim, if you're going to come here drinking, don't come. You're belligerent. Stay away. What I heard was, Kim, if you're going to come here, we don't like you. Stay away. Heard nothing about the drinking. I just figured they didn't like me. My blackouts back in those days somehow had video, no audio. I remember seeing people and they were really upset. I don't know what I was saying. My mouth was running. But I can't hear what I was saying. I could just see them being upset. And so that's kind of the way it was. because of how crazy it was, we made a geographical move again and moved here to Georgia. And we got here in the late 80s. And I went to work in the hospital. Tom actually got a job in all places, in the operating room at the VA center, where he could really get access to drugs. That was crazy. So during this time frame, I ended up getting hurt while I was working. I actually was restraining the patient, and I got my neck hurt. So now I was on pain pills, which actually was really tough because Tom was always trying to steal the pain pills. And it was really rough. It affected us financially. It was just a really rough time. during, because of the crisis thing, we ended up sending Tom to Talbot. Now we're actually in the late 90s. So he goes to Talbot Recovery Campus for his, I call it his $25,000 chip. While he's there, Talbot tries to tell him that I'm an alcoholic and that I'm in trouble. And we just know that's not true. They just wanted our money. They just wanted me to get a $25,000 chip. They're just, you know, jerks. But one of the things they did is they told him that I needed to go to Al-Anon and be part of his recovery. So I was really resentful about this because I was going to stop drinking to support his recovery. And I was going to have to go to these stupid meetings all the time to support his recovery. And I remember going into this church up there and telling the minister how mad I was about this. The minister just laughed and laughed and laughed. He thought that was so funny that I was in there just complaining about this. So in 1998, I started going to Al-Anon up in Buford. And I gave it a good try. I did stop drinking. Now, I was still taking those pain pills. And I did have to smoke a little pot every now and then to take the edge off. But I was not drinking from 1998 until the year 2000. But during that time frame, I wasn't. And I was really trying to do Al-Anon. And I really gave it my best effort. Now, Tom was not sober during this time. He was still doing pills and doing whatever he was doing. But I was giving it my best effort. So then in 2000, I took my kids up to New York without Tom for a vacation, and my parents wanted me to go wine tasting because my cousin was working at the winery. This is a good reason to go wine tasting. My parents were the enablers. Anyway, so I did, and when I went wine tasting, what occurred to me was like, do you know what? I've not had a drink for 2 years, and he's still drinking, and what the hell? Why am I doing without? This is stupid. I'm not an alcoholic. And I'm doing without alcohol and doing all this effort, and he's still drinking. This is stupid. I can drink. And my kids were having a fit. They were crying. They're upset. They're on the floor of that winery begging me to not drink. And I'm looking at them like they are the biggest brats ever, telling them, get up off that floor, you little brat. I don't have to not drink. And all I can tell you is that from that August of 2000, when I came back to Georgia, I felt like I had been reconnected with a long-lost friend. I had. My drinking was different. Number one, I was drinking on resentment. I was drinking on entitlement. And I was also now having to really hide it because I couldn't let everybody know I was drinking because I was supposed to be not drinking to support his sobriety, which wasn't a sobriety. So I had to like really clean the house, make sure everything was good, and then I'd go away on the weekends and try to find excuses to go away. And it was just insane. It was just insane, the grip it had on me. It was not like when I had drank before, which I could drink out in the open. It was different. And plus, my body was different. It was as if I had never stopped. I was different with alcohol. Still taking those pain pills. This is why I thought that maybe now these pain pills were really messing it up, because I was really twisted. Eventually, I couldn't just drink on the weekends. Eventually, I was drinking at home and hiding it. You know, it just changed me the way I was. But see, I was an Al-Anon, so I would go to Serenzi House to those AA meetings, and I would go in there at the Al-Anon meeting to understand a poor alcoholic relative, and I would never open my mouth. I would just go in there at Al-Anon. But I would listen to them, and I would think, oh, but I never got a DUI. Oh, but you know, I never had to go to treatment. You know, and no one was ever talking to me about my drinking, and I would find all the reasons not to connect, but all the reasons why I didn't belong. I could never hear. I didn't even see the steps in there. I didn't hear anything on why I was connected. So, but my drinking was getting worse, and it was just going bad. So by the summer of 2002, I actually thought, well, maybe I'll get a white chip. But I couldn't go up there and tell anybody. So what I would do is I would wait until the meeting was over, and I would sneak up to the person. I'd say, hey, give me a white chip. And so they would. Wouldn't anybody see it? I tried that white chip, and I would go home. I'd walk through the door, and Tom would have a joint. And I'd say, I'm going to have to pick another white chip. I wouldn't even make it and get back home. You know? And so I did that two or three times. And the third time that I lost it, I was in the car with my family, and I pulled up to a gas station. I had to go in and buy some alcohol. I just couldn't make it. And again, everybody's like crying in the car and upset. And I'm like, I don't care about this. I've got to have it. I just can't make it. So then I was like, okay, I did remember something, hearing in what something read out of a big book about how they favored hospitalization for the jittery type. And I thought, well, I'm really jittery, so maybe I just need to go to rehab. And about the same time, I got this message about my dad had lung cancer. And you know, that was it. You know, I can't move forward. I can't move backward. I can't live with alcohol. I can't live without it. I can't move. And now my dad's got lung cancer, and I can't do anything. So, oh my God, I gotta get off these pain pills. You know, I gotta do something. So it takes me all weekend to get into Peachford, but I finally get in on a Tuesday on August 27th. They locked me in, even though I went voluntarily. They took away my floss in case I wanted to grope myself. You know, they treated me like all those other people that were in there, locked up, crazy, on all kinds of drugs. They didn't know that I was unique and special. They treated me like everybody else. It just was so unfair. And there was this therapist down there. His name was Derry. Funny how you remember their names. But I kept telling him how different I was. And he kept telling me that he had my number and he was going to disconnect it. Anyway, I went through all that. I broke every rule. They didn't want me to keep my medicines to help me detox, because you need to detox off of drugs. It's very ugly. I was shaking like this all the time. But I kept all my meds that I needed for detoxing in the lodge, even though I wasn't supposed to. There was all kinds of rules that we had. Like, I wasn't supposed to have, guys weren't supposed to come to the girls' dorm. The girls weren't supposed to go to the dive. I broke that rule all the time. I had them over for cooking things. We did dinners all the time. I just, don't give me a rule. Don't tell me what I can't do. That was just ridiculous. Don't you know who I am? You know, it was so hard. I mean, I was willing to not have a drink today, but don't get me too good by Thursday. Don't make me do everything you're telling me to do. Don't you know it's just enough that I'm here? I've left my family. I've come here. Why do you guys have to be so hard on me? If you only knew how hard it was, you wouldn't make me wait 30 days for that chip. You'd give me one for every 7 days. It was just really hard. The people I was in rehab with told me if I went back home to that situation at home, I wouldn't stay sober. I wasn't going to make it. But the therapist down there told me these very important things. Number one, they were honest with me. They told me it was going to get worse before it got better. I'm glad they told me that. Because don't blow smoke up my butt and tell me it's going to get better. It's not. It's really hard. I just made my best friend. I got nothing in my toolbox to cope with. Right? So I got no coping skills whatsoever. No emotional muscle. Got nothing. And I'm going back to Drug Central at my house. And then the guy said, I went from self-pity to arrogant in 2.2 seconds. And he said that if I would go back and hold on to AA like a lifeline, that recovery was in the steps, work the steps. That's where I would find how to live without alcohol as my solution. So that's what I did. I went back. When I first got to AA, I went to the WRW Women's Recovery Workshop. And I swear to God, I went there, and all those women, who I didn't like women at all, and those women were giving each other stickers and hugging and kissing each other. And I thought, oh, my God, by the end of the weekend, we're going to be curling our hairs and making cookies. I'm going to die. But, you know what I did? I didn't know what to do with myself. I didn't know. I mean, I got up in the morning, and I was like, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to function. So I would go to a meeting, and they would say, okay, go back home. I'd pick up the phone, call my sponsor. She says, do you have dishes to do? Yes, go do the dishes. Call her back. To get this through. I mean, I was just that dependent initially. They told me just don't take a drink, come back to meetings, and that's what I did. Now, I didn't work with sponsors real easily because, number one, I didn't like the God thing. I've had a lot of bad experiences with church and God, which I didn't go into right now. We'll get to it maybe in later. I just had a really hard time with that. I had a hard time with people suggesting that I do things. So I fought with sponsors a great deal in the very beginning. I was very loud in the meetings about how you guys just don't know what I'm dealing with at home. If you only knew what I was dealing with at home, you'd understand why I'm not going to make it. And so somebody would open up the book and point out page 98 and tell me, burn into the consciousness of every man that he can get sober regardless of job, family, whatever. And I'd be like, oh, I just don't understand. But anyway, meanwhile, I wasn't drinking and I was staying sober. And I was learning the serenity prayer. And, you know, people were helping me. And then I was giving people rides to meetings, and I would be complaining about them because they weren't staying sober, and I'm giving them rides. And they'd say, but Kim, Are you sober? Yes. Yeah. So finally I had a sponsor that told me to listen to the Joe and Charlie CDs, which I did. So I started learning about Pearl by listening to those. And then I had a sponsor that told me I was really fighting third step because I had lost that child. There's a big spiritual thing about losing that child because I had prayed about that, and that child didn't make it. So I had a huge God problem with there. And so she said to listen to Otto M. from Texas. And so I listened to his CD, and Otto's got a really bad story. And his concept was that he believed that God could want him to be sober and like it. Okay. All right, fine, I'll do that. I can believe that maybe God wants me to be sober and like it. I can give him that much. And how about good orderly direction? Okay, I can do that. And maybe I can get this little bit for the rest of these steps. I ain't giving you anything else. I give you that, and I'll work the rest of these steps. So based on that, I sat at this little strip mall with the sponsor, and I did the third step prayer. And the next day, she sent me an email and fired me and said that my recovery, my sickness was too big for her recovery. Holy hell, what's going on? So I got this other sponsor right after that who ended up being the very sponsor I needed. And she helped me with the rest of getting ready for the fourth step. But now we're into the summer of 2003. I decided to move out from the house. Wasn't against my husband. Told him I was doing it for myself, not against him. Got an apartment, was terrified, having panic attacks. My sponsor helped me through all that. My father wanted me to take him back to New York to say his goodbyes to all his family. So I'm going back to New York, you know, where my drinking was. But I was able to do that, and I was able to help my mom and dad do that. And I went to a four-step Al-Anon convention with all those Al-Anoners who forgate, well, they were so good. And I heard a four-step workshop. And then I went down to Florida for my dad to pick up a car, and he had a turn for the worse. And on August 27th, on my one-year anniversary, I was with my father when he took his last breath. And I want you to know it's at that moment. Because it took me all that time to get in rehab. I didn't pick August 27th for any purpose. But the day that he died, on my first AA birthday, that's when it clicked. It was like, oh, I get it. I get it. This whole year of fighting and resisting and just not wanting to be here. I'm here. And I was the calm one. Everybody else was falling apart. I thought we were going to hold hands and sing kumbaya, you know. But I want you to know, in situations like that, when emotions run high, people are not their best. People are their worst. Everybody was horrible. They were all emotional. But I wasn't. I was the one who was calm. This is crazy. No one ever said that about me. I was the one who was calm and put together, and I was there and present for everybody at that moment. And I saw God in my life, and it just opened up. And man, I was on fire then to do stuff. So I got busy working my fourth step. I made amends to my husband, which was crazy. That just set me on fire. I saw the promises coming true, and I just wanted to do more and more and more. My sponsor would have me do things like be the greeter at the door, which I did not love. I wasn't loving hugging people, but I did it. And you know what? She had me get into service work, which I started doing by literature person. Eventually, I was like the district secretary. I just did stuff. And the more I got involved, the more I got plugged in, the more my life began to happen. You know, I ended up going, my first job, believe it or not, I had been a nurse, but I had been on disability. I let my license go. I ended up getting my license back and going to work. So I'm out searching for jobs. And, you know, suiting up, show up for jobs. I was so no confidence. So I'm writing letters, sending them out. So I send one to Peachford because they had a job opening. Do you know they called me? I'm like, oh, my God, I don't want to go there. And they said, Kim, just suit up, show up. So I said, fine, I'll go do a practice interview. So I go to Peachford. I'm doing this practice interview. They offer me the job. I'm like, oh, my God. I'm going to have to tell them I'm not just a hair club member. I'm a hair club member. So that was cool. So I spent the first year of my first job working at Peachford. I was so humble because I never felt qualified to be there. I really felt like I was on the other side of that desk. Now I'm here. So it was a good place for me to learn utter dependence on God. Because every day I pray, God, help me not hurt anybody there. You be here. You go first. You go first. And so that was excellent. And then, you know, after a year, I went and did something different. But that's the way my jobs have been. To this very day, what I do today, I always say, God, listen, what are we doing today, God? You go first. You know, so you ought to protect those people for me. And that's how we rolled. So life started getting back and buying a house, which was crazy. I'd only been back to work for 6 weeks, and somehow I'm buying a house, which is crazy. So life goes on. My husband ended up dying from this disease. It was very sad and tragic, but that's what happened. I was really mad at God about that for a minute. And then somebody said, pray to God about that, and I'm like, oh. But, you know, God has his own story with each of us. He has no grandchildren, and he gets to choose how he deals with each of us, and I don't get to have I didn't have a say on that. But ultimately, God's the one who's in charge. So, you know, that's kind of like what happened, what it was like, and what happened. So what's it like really now? I want to bring it current because now we're 20-some years into that. I got remarried at about 5 years. Now, this was to somebody who had about 12 years in recovery. We both had been going to church. You know, I prayed about this. This wasn't like me being off the rails. I mean, I really prayed for God's will on this. And I want to mention this because sometimes you pray for God's will and then things are not turning out like you think. And so you're thinking, well, what is this? Is God up there going, hot? Let it figure it out today? I really thought it was going to be, oh, this is going to be so great. He's doing program. I'm doing program. I want you to know, it was like not long after we got married, it was not working out the way I thought it was going to work out. We had different ideas. He said I was going to do everything he liked. He said he liked it. And I was thinking, no, we were going to be equal partners. And that's just not the way it was working out. We struggled. We struggled a lot. He left me more than he stayed with me. He was from here 2 years, he'd leave. Be gone for a few months, and he'd come back. And it was just, this was on and off. And we were married for 13 years. And so every 4 years, he'd leave and come back. Now, there was no violence. He didn't drink, I didn't drink. But we struggled. And so while we were struggling, I want you to know this program was a lifeline for me. Man, did I do service work. I did archive. I sponsored people. I mean, this is where I grew spiritually. This is what helped me. And there were people that had their opinions about what we were going on. But, you know, I continued to grow. And I think sometimes when you're really going through tough stuff, when you continue to enlarge your spiritual growth, man, I was enlarging my spiritual growth for sure. I mean, sometimes I was in the shower going, God, is this what you really wanted for me? Why did you bring me here? I mean, I wasn't always full of grace going, oh, I'm just doing this thing. I mean, it was really tough. But this is what happened with that. Come 2019, we were in a period of where we were apart, but he had come back to Florida, to Georgia, and he was actually staying at an apartment that I had because I had sold my house and he was in an apartment. He was actually renting a room for me. It was kind of crazy. But he was doing his thing, I was doing my thing. We were great roommates. We were getting along. When all of a sudden he got diagnosed with liver cancer, that was very aggressive and very rapid. And at the time, we were actually seeing a therapist together working on our own character defects, thinking, you know, if we were going to split for real, we wanted to kind of know what we had done and go away better people. Like I said, we got along well. When that happened, we were actually still married. Because we were still married, I could step into that role as his wife and be there for him. And I got closure. So he took his last breath on April 2nd of 2020, right as that pandemic was starting. I was able to get him out of the hospital and get him home. And I want you to know that that relationship for all this spiritual growth, I came away from that with such spiritual peace. And I know that he had a good death, all things considered, that he had a peaceful end to his life because we ended peacefully. There was no angst. Now, he could have left and gone back in 2018. We could have divorced, and God would have still cared for him. I don't think he had to have me to have a good ending because I'm not that egotistical. But I'm so grateful that because I hung in there and kept doing the next right thing and letting God lead me every day, by being surrendering to God's will for my life, that I got to have that level of peace. And I get to walk with that today. I don't carry any angst and any. I'm not carrying all that ick that I could have been carrying had I not let God lead me through all that. And I got to grow a lot. I'm a much different person today because of it. My two adult children have now moved back in with me because children bounce back, and I'm able to let them be who they are. And, now, granted, sometimes I'm going into my bathroom saying, oh, But I'm not saying that to her face, right? I'm letting her be who she is. And then, you know, and sometimes I just have to let them be who they are. I need to be attraction today on being a good person. I don't think you get anybody to be a better person by being an asshole, by not being a good person to them. I'm trying to say it in my language. My grandchildren will say language. I'm like, trying to be better. I don't think you get anybody to be better by being hate. Hate does not get about love. Love always brings love. And so I have to really work on that. Over the years of this process, I came into here disabled. I was a disability when I came in here. Not only get my nursing license back, through these years, I ended up going back to school. So I came in disabled. I said, you can't get to where I am now. I eventually got my doctorate. So now I have my doctorate. I'll do palliative care. So what I do every day now is I go to people's homes and I bring comfort and peace. It takes a lot out of me, right? I can't do this all the time, full time, without being fed somewhere. So I come to meetings, and when I walk through the door at a meeting, I'm just kindergarten variety alcoholic. I need to check that who I am at the door. And I need that. I need to fill up spiritually and to bring that. So after that 2020 thing where I was so in the pandemic, what happened, and this is why I want to talk about this right now, and I'm doing okay on time. I'm looking. Oh, God, 30 minutes. I was really worried that I was going to talk over. This is really where I really needed to, I need to share this with y'all. So I appreciate you. Let me share it. For the past 5 years, what happened after Ed died and the pandemic and being so pulled away from meetings, I had started the 7-Up group in 2013 because I needed meetings and I was doing so much school. I started the meeting at 7 in the morning. And I went to that almost every day for 7 years. And then in 2020, between the move and everything that happened with in-law meetings, it was really hard for me to feel connected online. I just couldn't. And I don't know whether that's a spiritual thing or I was just pulled apart or whatever, but I just couldn't feel connected. I had plenty of people I was still talking to. I would do hit or miss meetings where I try to plug in, but I just couldn't feel plugged in no matter what. And I wasn't doing service work anymore, right? I was too busy doing all these other things. And so people would talk to me about Zoom meetings. I don't like Zoom meetings. You can't see. I feel like a fly on the wall. I'm not really participating in them. I couldn't get into them, really. I couldn't feel a part of. And I tried, I wasn't down in Buford anymore because I moved up to Winder. I tried finding other groups. I would go to those meetings and I would sit in there, but I could never feel like I was a part of. Nowhere did I feel like, nowhere felt like home. I joined a home group. I joined the Christian group and I would go there, picked up a couple of chips there, you know, but I never felt like I belonged. I just couldn't find home. I was just restless. This is like past 5 years that's where I've been. So last year, I've been talking to people and I've been working with my sponsor. I've done 4 steps even this whole time. But again, just feeling like I'm on the outside. I'm not in. So in January, I decided I just couldn't take anymore. I was going to have to do something. So I went back to the 7-Up Zoom group. I also went to the Gainesville Classic. And I'll tell you about the Gainesville Classic. That's so cool. When you go to the Gainesville Classic, they have hybrid meetings. One of the things that they did was very good for me is that they involved me. They pull you in. They're like, hey, Kim, would you read something? Hey, Kim, would you do this? They call me by name, and they pulled me in. And that really made a difference for me. They didn't let me be a fly on the wall. They pulled me in. And that was very good. So I started doing the 7-Up Zoom meeting, which is part of that original 7-Up that I was very involved in. And they really kind of needed some help because they were struggling. So I started doing that every day. And all of a sudden, that took shape and form. And all of a sudden, I'm doing service work. And I'm there every day. And I'm fitting in. I'm home again. I'm home. And I'm doing service work. And I'm thinking, you know, when I retire in a few years, I think what I'll do is I'll be one of those ladies, old ladies, that go to meetings and they got that flock of sponsees around them. And I'll be spontaneous when I have time. I don't have time now. I'm working all the time. Well, I'm doing the service work by being at the meeting every day. And we have all these people coming now, all these newcomers coming in. And next thing you know, I'm picking up sponsees. And now I've got 3 or 4 sponsees. And somehow, I've got time. I don't know where that time came from. It just popped up. Somehow, I've got time. I'm going to workshops, and I'm doing all this stuff. And all of a sudden now, I'm connected. I don't know how that happened. It's July. And I don't know what happened between January and July, except for I became active, and I started doing service work again. And so I guess, and my friend was telling me, she goes, but Kim, weren't you just telling me how you didn't like a Zoom? Didn't you just tell me it wouldn't work? And now I've become like a Zoom advocate, because what I'm realizing, what our role is with the Zoom, like at first it was the COVID, it was in place of sometimes person meetings, but we are actually carrying the message. I have people who come to our meetings now because they're afraid to go to in-person meetings for the first time, and they come to the in-Zoom meetings to get an introduction, and we encourage them to go to in-person meetings. Just like when you come to these meetings, we say, don't just go to open discussions. Go to speaker meetings. Go to big book studies. Go to 12 and 12. Get a variety. And if you don't like this meeting, find another one. If you go to a meeting that you think is bad, then find another one. You know, variety is the spice of life. And then by all means, get into service. Service can be coffee. It can be a greeter. And then when you get some time in your back, chair a meeting. You know, get active, because the one thing that this meeting, this disease feeds on is isolation. What thrives on is connection. And you connect when you find your spot. And sponsorship is vital. We have people that don't want to do sponsorship because they're afraid. It's like, well, then don't do sponsorship. Just try calling people. And if you don't want to talk about you, ask them how you do it today. When I first came in, I wouldn't call people. I'd call answer machines and leave messages. That way I wouldn't have to talk to anybody. You know, and, oh, my God, they call me back. Then I have to talk to them. You know, because I just didn't want to talk. So I guess that's my thing about today, is that I hear people sometimes come in, and they'll have 20, 25 years, 30 years, and they'll talk about how they went back out, and they drank again. And I think, oh, how does that happen? How could that possibly happen? I think, I don't ever want to drink again. And that's the truth, I don't. But I realize now the way that it can happen is that we get disconnected. And how close I came, I was on my way out the door without even knowing it, just by being disconnected. And I'm so grateful to be here tonight, so grateful to share my story. And for those of you who are new, find a spot, plug in, stay. For those of you who've got some time, please never disconnect, find a spot, and stay. So that's all I got to share. Thank you.
First I slip, and then I quit. Something that's